talk about a conjecture of Kemp, Kleinberg, and Tardosch, which says something about how word of mouth propagates on social networks, and in particular, how this can sort of be exploited for marketing purposes. So I'll just... I'll just sort of give the conjecture and sort of motivate it, and then I'll give a very high-level idea of the proof. So the kind of behavior that I'd like to be able to model are the following. So these are sort of examples. The first one is sort of a classical sociology example, which is, imagine that a riot breaks out, and every person in the crowd has to decide whether or not they want to participate in that riot. A more sort of modern commercial example is some new product appears on the market, and every person has to decide whether or not they want to buy it, or a movie comes out, do you want to see it, and so on. So these are sort of behaviors where, first of all, you have a sort of binary decision. Everybody chooses sort of 0, 1, and it's sort of increasing. Everybody sort of starts at 0, and then some people go to 1, and then it just sort of settles down. I'm interested in understanding how people influence each other, so there will be a sort of a social network below it, and then so people are going to influence each other. And the main dynamical aspect of it is going to be a cascade effect, where there's some sort of trendsetters at first. They influence their friends to buy this product, and then they influence other people, and so on, until the process stops. Okay, and the application that I mentioned is something that's called viral marketing in data mining. So in traditional marketing, you would have a certain product that you know appeals to a certain slice, say, of demographics, and you would try to figure out where these people are and try to target them in some way by advertising. In viral marketing, there's this idea that a potential customer is not only valuable because it may or may not buy a product, but it's also valuable because it may influence its friends to also buy the product. And so they call this the network value. And this is sort of known to be very effective. People always give this example in the literature, which is Hotmail, where with a very minimal marketing budget, in the space of a few months, they managed to get a dozen million people to subscribe, just because every time somebody sends an email, there's a little referral at the end of the email or something. Okay, so what we'd like to do in viral marketing is to figure out which customers out there have the highest network value, and try to target them directly by, say, giving them free samples or discounts, and try to optimize the word of mouth effect in the network by choosing the right people. And so how would you do this? Well, imagine that you're Amazon.com, for example, and you have this reward system where people, when somebody buys a product, you give them the possibility of recommending it to their friends by email. And then there's this reward where once a friend buys the product, they get a 10% discount, and then the recommender also gets a 10% discount. You could collect data about that and try to understand how people, your customers, actually influence each other, and try to figure out which ones maybe are sort of more influential, and try to target them more specifically. Now, if you're not Amazon and you just have access to public databases, there's this work by Domingos and Richardson where they look, for example, at a website called opinions.com, where people post reviews of just about anything. And every person also has a list of trusted reviewers. And so when you're searching for a certain item, you're shown a bunch of reviews of this item. And the ones that you see first are actually the ones that come from your trusted reviewers. And so they're implicit. The way they do here in Domingos and Richardson is they assume that when somebody writes a review, is because they bought a product, and then they assume that the social network is just these trusted reviewers that influence each other. And by looking at who buys a product at what time, they try to figure out, there's no time here. They actually use a sort of static model. They try to figure out which customers have more influence in this network, and then assume that they will target them directly. how would you, so now I want to formalize the model that I'm interested in, and I'm going to go back to some work in sociology from the 1970s. So this Bernovetter guy is came up with this model. So this is for the example that he uses is the joining the riot. So you have a riot, these are the people on the square. There's a sort of an early trendsetter. This guy starts the riot. At this point, there's not much of a riot, but these other people may or may not want to join this this riot. If you find the riot image a little too graphic, you can give other examples. One is leaving social situations, for example, if you're at a boring dinner party or at a boring talk, and you would like to leave. And some people have different levels of politeness. Some people will wait for a few people, the first three before they do, and others will just leave whenever they feel like. Okay? So these, what's going to happen is that each person is going to have a threshold value. Think of that as the sort of level of politeness. And then they decide to join the riot or leave once the fraction that's written on that node has already joined. So here we have 10 nodes. At this point, the zero guy is just the initiator. At this point, there's 10%. So the guys who have a 10% threshold are going to join in. Right, now you have 40%. Everybody who has a threshold below 40% is going to join in. And then we have 70%, and these guys are not going to join in. And that's the end of the process. So this is Bernovetter's threshold model. Now, one thing that's missing here that I mentioned first is I want to model a network structure. So this is easy to fix. I just assume that my nodes are actually connected in a network. And now, instead of looking at everybody, each node is just going to look at its neighbors. And each node is going to grab a threshold, and it's going to join in once that threshold has been reached, but in its neighbor's line. And I'm going to do something more, which is, I don't like the fact that it's sort of deterministic model. There's a lot of uncertainty here, and I'd like to introduce some randomness. And the way that I'm going to do it, which is a little bit arbitrary, I'm going to assume that my threshold values are sort of unknown, and that I pick them uniformly at random in 0, 1. So rather than having some fixed threshold values for each node, I'm just independently for each node going to pick a uniform 0, 1 variable, and this is going to be the threshold. And then from there, I just run the process. Right? So I start here with the initiator. This guy now has 33% of its neighbor that have already joined. It's higher than its threshold value, so it's going to join. The same for this one, and so on, until it settles. And this is called the linear threshold model. Actually, I can do more than that. I can also imagine that I have weights on my edges, so some neighbors influence or have more influence than others, and instead of, I'm just going to have a linear, once a certain linear function of the neighbors have crossed the threshold, I just join.
I'm sorry, Sebastian. So, yes. So what's the rule again? When does a person join the riot? When his neighbors?
So here in this weighted version, it would be once the sum of all the infected or all the one that already joined, the sum of the weights on their edges crosses my threshold value.
Okay. And the weights are the thresholds of the other.
And the weights are arbitrary weights that I put on the edges.
Oh, I see.
But the threshold are random.
I see.
So there's no reason for these to be symmetric, right? The weights.
That's a good point. It should have been a directed graph. Okay. Should have been a directed graph with arbitrary weights. And I should say that contrary to other talks, my graphs are going to be deterministic. There's no randomness in the graph as well. Okay, so this may seem like a bit of an unnatural model. And to sort of justify that, it's actually more general than you would think. I'm going to first give you a different model, which is a bit more natural. And then I'll generalize both of them in a sort of model that contains a lot more general situation. So this is called the independent cascade model. And it works as follows. I still have a graph. On each edge, again, it should have been directed edges. On each edge, I have a probability of succeeding to infect a neighbor. So once you, once you're infected, you get one chance, then one chance only, of infecting every one of your neighbors, and the probability that you succeed is the probability that's attached to the corresponding edge. Okay, so this guy starts there. This is my initiator. It gets one chance to infect this neighbor with probability 0.5. In this case, it succeeds. It tries this one. In this case, it fails. Now, this one tries to infect its own neighbors with probability 0.5. It succeeds, and so on until the process stops. Yeah. That's a different model than the first one. And now, let me just generalize everything to something that's sort of a natural generalization of the first one, whereas instead of having this linear threshold, I'm just going to have a general function. This is called the generalized threshold model by Kemp, Kleinberg, and Tardosh. I have a graph G, an initial set S0, and now to each node, I'm going to have an activation function, fu of S, so U is my node. S is a subset of neighbors, which are the infected neighbors. So this, in the first example, this was just a linear function of the infected neighbors. My threshold value is going to be, as before, a uniform 0-1 variable. And then the dynamics are going to be the following. You start with S0, and then at time st, you add to st minus 1 all the nodes that have crossed their threshold, so such that fu of their infected neighbors at time t minus 1 is larger than k.
Do you require that the activation function is monotone in S?
Yes, it should be monotonely increasing. That's a good point. Another point is that it's going to stop after n minus 1 steps. So at every step, either it doesn't infect anybody, it stops, or it infects at least one, and then after n minus 1 step, there's not going to be anybody left to infect. So I'm going to actually assume that my process always takes exactly n minus 1 steps and stops after n minus 1 steps. And the other thing is that this model actually generalizes both the previous ones. So the first one is just by taking f to be a linear function. The second one, which was this cascade model, you have to specify the right f, but it actually turns out that you can write this cascade model in this sort of uniform threshold way. And you can actually generalize that to any kind of model where at each step a node has, every time it's infected, it gets one chance to infect all of its neighbors, but instead of just being some p that depends on the edge, it could also depend on who has tried previously and failed. And you could also rewrite this in this way. And you could also have a more general theta instead of 0-1, right? A 0-1 variable can just generate any kind of a variable just by applying the inverse distribution function. And so you just take the distribution function on the other side and you could get a function of the threshold, which is sort of an arbitrary distribution function. So this is going to be my model. The other point I want to make is I'm not going to refer anymore to the graph. The graph is sort of implicitly written in these function f's, and then I just implicitly, f depends only on the neighbors of u. And the problem I want to solve, so this is my viral marketing problem, where I have this graph where people influence each other, and I'd like to find a small subset of trendsetters that I'm going to target directly, which have the largest possible influence in this model. And now, am I going to measure that? This is going to be the influence of s. So suppose that I have an initial seed s. I said my process stopped after n minus 1 steps. Suppose that I look at the size of the final set that's infected, and I take the expectation given that I started with s. So this is going to be the influence of s, the expected size of the final set infected. And now the influence maximization problem is just going to be, I want to find a subset of a certain size k that maximizes the influence. This is going to be my viral marketing. And it turns out that in general, it's NPR. It's actually even general. It's in NPR, even in the independent cascade case, which is a very simple special case of that. So people have used heuristics to solve this kind of problem, which are sort of standard in maybe social network analysis. one of is degree centrality, so you just find the k vertices that have the highest degrees, and those are sort of the ones that are supposed to have the highest influence. Or you could use instead of the average distance to every other node in the graph, you take the k nodes that have the highest or the smallest average distance to the rest of the graph, and you use that as your solution. Now, those, first of all, there's no actual guarantee that those are going to give good results. They sort of depend only on the actual graph and not on the dynamics of the system, which is which could be useful to think about. And then they tend to be a little redundant in that it could be the case that all the I degree nodes are actually highly clustered and connected together. And so once you have one, it sort of influences the same people as the second highest degree. And you might want to think about using other nodes that are maybe a more distance from the main cluster. So what I'd like to do is to find some sort of good polynomial time approximation algorithm to solve this influence maximization problem. And to do that, I'm going to have to simplify it or to add a bit more structure to the problem. So I'm going to define a function to be submodular. So a function of subsets of nodes is submodular if FA. So if you take two arbitrary sets A and B, FA plus FB is larger than F of the union plus F of the intersection. And if you rewrite that differently, it's just a sort of discrete concavity condition where if you take a subset S and a subset T, which is bigger than S, adding an arbitrary node to T will increase the function less than if you add the same node to a match actually smaller set. But this is also often called diminishing returns. And a typical example of that would be any concave function of the cardinality of your set, a submodular function. And so back to my threshold model, I'm going to actually assume that my activation functions are not only monotone, but they also have diminishing returns, so they're submodular. And this actually, yeah, it's going to be useful for algorithmic reasons, but it's also sort of natural in the sense that it just means that as you get more and more recommendation of a certain product, the marginal effect of these extra recommendations just sort of diminishes in time. And this was actually observed in the particular context of viral marketing by Leskovic, Adamich, and Uberman. So they took this Amazon.com, well, they don't say if it's Amazon.com, but it looks like it. this reward system where you get a 10% discount if one of your friends follows your recommendations, and they look at DVDs, and they have this graph where they show the probability that somebody is going to buy a DVD given the number of recommendations that they've received, and you get this sort of concave looking DVD. I'm not saying that this proved that the activation functions are so much limited. It could be one interpretation of this graph. So finally, the result is the following. If you assume that all your activation functions are monotone and submodular, then, well, that was first been conjectured by KKT, then the influence itself is also monotone and submodular. And this is relevant because in the influence maximization problem, what I was doing was to maximize this function, which is now submodular. And there's a whole machinery for maximizing submodular function. And now you can get good approximation algorithm for this particular problem. And here algorithm is just a greedy algorithm where you just add to your set the node that increases the influence by the most. You do that k times and that gives you a good approximation to your set. So this was proved in some special cases by KKT again in two papers. In the two special cases that I mentioned at first, which were the linear threshold model and the independent cascade model. And then in this weird looking condition, which looks like submodularity but has this sort of normalization here. So if you have it for all set S including T, this inequality, KKT proved that the influence is submodular. And so if you just ignore the denominator, this is really just submodularity. And this normalization comes from, it's a sort of conditioning that they use in their proofs. What is this? It's like the probability that the uniform random variable would be in this interval, given that it's in this interval. And so in their proof, at every step, they sort of condition on what's happened so far, and they get this weird denominator. And the game will be to somehow remove this conditioning to get the full submodularity. Give a quick sketch of the proof. Before I do, I just want to mention some literature. I've also already mentioned the sociology and data mining. As far as I know, this probabilistic model has not been studied in the probability theory literature in that generality. I haven't found any paper. But it's clearly reminiscent of other things. It sort of looks like a generalized percolation model. And it's also related to, you know, in spirit at least, to some other models that are used to model the spread of infection, like the contact process and the voter model. So the proof is not actually going to use any of that machinery, but it's going to use a very basic tool which is used there, which is the coupling method. And then Markov random fields, because the work of Domingos and Richardson, instead of having this dynamic of cascades, they just have a static distribution for how people influence each other, which they write as a Markov random field. There's a connection there. I'm not going to talk about it. So this is what I want to prove. I have my two arbitrary sets A and B, and I want to prove that the influence of A plus the influence of B is bigger than the influence of the intersection plus the influence of the union. And now, I'm going to do that by coupling four processes. So suppose that you have a process AT that starts at A, which does the generalized threshold model. BT starts at B, CT starts at the intersection. I'm going to call that the intersection process. And DT starts at the union. And now you want to couple them. So I don't know if everybody knows what coupling means. I just want to specify a joint process A, B, C, D, such that marginally A, B, C, and D have the right distribution. Okay. So a trivial example of that would be, remember that the way my process is defined is I pick a theta vector, one theta for each vertex. I could use independent theta vectors for each one of them, so theta A, theta B, theta C, theta D, and I just run them simultaneously. That's sort of a trivial coupling. A less trivial coupling would be I could, instead of having four independent thetas, I could just have one theta vector, and I use the same one for each one of them. Now, each one of them marginally has the right distribution, but jointly they have some extra property that might turn out to be useful. And so what exactly is it that could be useful? Suppose I have a coupling of the four processes. Look at the very first time, at the initial set, you have A0, B0, C0, D0. Those actually already satisfy this type of equation. That is, the size of A0 plus the size of B0 is actually equal to the size of C0 plus the size of B0. If I was able to simulate these four processes simultaneously such that I preserve this property at every step, then in particular at the very end, I would have the right thing. And then when I take expectation, I would get exactly this inequality. So one thing that would give me that is to get a coupling that has this type of behavior. If I could make it such that at every time CT, so the intersection process, is always included in the intersection of A and B, and D, the union process, is always included in the union of A and B, then you'd get that directly. At the last step, n minus 1, you always have that just by definition, and then by these two equations, this is larger than that, and you just take expectation and you get that back. The name of the game is you have these four processes that you know what they look like marginally, and you somehow want to simulate them at the same time to preserve this. And it turns out that it's somewhat non-trivial to do. So I said the obvious way to couple is to just say, well, let's just take one theta vector that I use for every one of these processes. Now, if you do that, it actually satisfies one just by monotonicity. I'm not going to prove that, but it's easy to see. But it actually doesn't satisfy two. Because like two, right, D is the one that starts with the union, it's actually much bigger, and it somehow manages to reach nodes that are not are reachable by either A and B, and you're not able to satisfy two. And so the idea will be to use a different coupling, which I'm going to call the anti-sense coupling, which is the following. Suppose that I have a theta vector for A, and then instead of picking the same theta for B, I'm actually going to take 1 minus theta. One minus theta is still uniform, it's just the interval 0 and it's just flipped. And now this is interesting because of the following reason. Suppose that theta is small, there's a small threshold, it means that A should be, you know, should have a good chance of actually infecting this node. Whereas if theta is large, there's a high threshold, so it's unlikely that A might be able to reach this particular node. But 1 minus theta is going to be small, and so B might have a good chance to actually infect it. And so in some way, it sort of maximizes the union of A and B, which should help you to get this kind of condition. Now, I haven't told you exactly how this is going to work, and I didn't tell you what happens with C and D. It's actually more complicated than that. You have to somehow couple, use the two couplings. But this is going to be the sort of basic idea behind it. And I'm going to need some further tricks. One of them is, so it turns out that just coupling them like this vanilla is really difficult, and it's going to be easier to somehow separate the process in several stages. And at first you start with the intersection, then you add some more, and you add some more, and eventually you get the full process. I'm going to describe that in more precisely in a second. And the other one is, it turns out that, you know, in the way that I've described the process so far, I just pick the thetas at first, and I run the process on those thetas. You can also somehow unveil only the minimum amount of information that you need about theta as you go, and this turns out to help you in coupling the two processes. So let me describe those two things more in detail. So the first one is what I call piecemeal growth, where instead of I want to run my generalized threshold model starting with the process, the set S. Now, suppose that I have a partition of S, S1 through SK. It turns out that I can do something different, which is instead of starting with all of S, picking my thetas and running the process until it stops after n minus 1 steps, I could also do, I start with S1, I run the process for n minus 1 steps, then I add S2, and then I run the process for another n minus 1 steps. And the claim is that those two things actually give you the same thing. Okay? And this is actually kind of trivial, and I'm not going to show you how you do this. But the point is, instead of having only one phase, you can actually have, say, k phases of n minus 1 steps. And at the end, you get the same thing. Now, the more interesting one is the anti-sense coupling. How do you actually implement this 1 minus theta idea? Suppose that I have a set S and T, which are disjoint. I have a partition of S in S1 through SK. My process ST is just going to be the process that runs the piecemeal process in the previous slide, S1 through SK, and then T. Whereas the process T is going to be the following. It's going to do the same thing for the first K phases, but then when it gets to T, it's going to change its threshold values, and instead of using theta, it's going to use theta prime, which is this thing. Okay, which has two things. This is the 1 minus theta that I'm trying to use, and the f there, it's going to turn out that theta somehow is in this interval, and this thing is actually flipping the sort of remaining interval. This is going to be clear in the next slide. So, and the claim is that at the end of these two processes, you have the same distribution, which is all you need because you just want that the expectation at the final step satisfies the submodularity condition. So where is this coming from? So this is how it's going to work. Suppose that Bob wants to simulate this process. He could do it in two different ways. One is he could flip the coins at first to get those thetas and just run the process as we described before. Or he could use a friend, say Alice. And Alice flips the coins and gets the thetas. But now Alice is not allowed to tell Bob what the thetas are. Instead, all she's allowed to do is answer questions of the type, is theta in some interval? And the way I'm going to, and the way Bob is going to simulate the process now is just that at every time your activation function has reached a new value, and you just want to know is that if that new activation value has reached the threshold. Okay, so from time s t minus 2 to t minus 1, I've reached this new interval, and the question is, have I reached the threshold value? And the nice thing about that is, suppose that you get the answer no, suppose that you only ask this kind of question, if you get the answer no, it means that conditionally on what Bob has seen so far, theta is actually uniformly distributed in the remaining interval, so ST minus 1 to 1. And so here's how I'm going to prove the dilemma. In the first case stages, I'm just going to run these two processes, S and T, identically with this simulation. So Alice answers the same, give the same answer for both S and T. And then at the end of the first case stages, all the nodes that have not been infected, I know because I got the answer no, that actually theta is uniformly distributed in the remaining interval, the activation function to 1. And now the point is that theta prime, which is just theta where you flip the interval fv, tkn minus 1, and 1, is also conditionally uniformly distributed in that interval. And then it actually gives the same distribution. So in this last step, all I do is I take theta uniformly in that interval, I run s on that, and then I run t on theta prime. And at the very last step, I have exactly the same distribution. So the way the proof is going to go is I'm going to have three phases. So time goes like this. I'm going to have my four processes A, B, and then C and D on the other slide. And the three phases are going to be, first I start with the intersection, then I add A minus B, and then I add B minus A if it's relevant. So I use the same thetas for everything. So for A, I start with the intersection. I grow it for n minus 1 step, I get this. And then in the second phase, I add a minus b, I grow it for n minus 1 step, I get this. And then I don't add b minus a because a doesn't include b minus a. Now for the process b, again, I use the same theta. So in the first phase, I start with the intersection, and I get exactly the same result. I don't do the phase a minus b because that's not included in b. And then for the last phase, I do the anti-sense thing by adding first b minus a, and then doing the antisense coupling for the last phase. Okay, so this is what I get. And then I do similarly for C and D. C is just the intersection process, so I just do the first phase, and I get the same thing as A and B. And then for D, I do the three phases with the antisense at the end. And so I've drawn here the intersection of A and B compared to C, and you know, that satisfies what I want, and the union of A and B compared to D, and this also satisfies what I want. And the reason this works is this slide. Right, so I'm trying to satisfy these two conditions. The fact that C is always included in A, intersection B is just obvious by the way that I've simulated this process. At the end of the first phase, they're all identical, and then C doesn't move anymore, and the other ones continue to add something to it. This is always going to be true. The other one is less trivial. So in the first two phases, A and B are actually identical. I do the intersection and A minus B. And for D, I do exactly the same thing. So at the end of the first two phases, A dominates D. And then in the last phase, because of my antisense thing now, B is going to dominate whatever D is trying to add. And this is going to come from the submodularity. And so I add b minus a for my last phase, but I add b minus a to a smaller set b and to a bigger set d, and by the submodularity I get this kind of condition, which when you rewrite it with the theta prime is exactly what you need. So whatever b gets by crossing this threshold, b also gets, and then b just ends up dominating d. So at the end, just by induction, you get exactly the same thing throughout the last phase, and then in particular at the last time step, process satisfy this sort of some modularity structure. And so you get the result that I said before. You actually get something more, which is instead of using the cardinality of the final set, you could have some sort of weight function of the final set, which if it's monotone and submodular, is going to give you the same result. So you can check that it still works. And for some sort of generalized influence, you still get that the generalized influence is also submodular. So you could do the same kind of a greedy algorithm. And this is actually the end. I just want to say, just some open things that are not clear. It's really not clear how you're going to infer this model. I just sort of assume that I know the graph, and that I know all these activation functions and so on. Actually, inferring them is non-trivial, and it's clear that the work of Domingos and Richardson, is non-trivial. And they have a different model, but it's still interesting. And then there's the question of, can you actually combine that with your traditional marketing? Right? What I've done here is just to try to exploit the network value by itself. Can you somehow do both and get something interesting?